Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and National Grassroots and Outreach Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, Jason Fichtner, a senior lecturer and an associate director of the Master of International Economics and Finance program at Johns Hopkins University, and Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, will join the show to discuss Social Security, retirement planning, fiscal and economic policy, monetary policy, long-term fiscal responsibility, and the latest Congressional Budget Office Federal Budget Review. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for CQ Roll Call is reporting that the House may vote on a stopgap funding measure next week to avoid a government shutdown, but there's still no agreement on how long a stopgap should last. A House vote next week would give the Senate plenty of time to clear the measure before the new fiscal year begins on October 1st. None of the dozen fiscal 2021 appropriations bills will become law on time, meaning all federal agencies and departments will need some kind of extension of current funding. Republicans, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, want the temporary measure to last into December, while some Democrats want the bill to last into early next year. The partisan dispute over timing simply reflects political considerations. Federal agencies would be required to post on their websites detailed justification documents for their annual budget requests to Congress under legislation the House passed on Monday. Under the bill, the Office of Management and Budget would be charged with creating a separate website compiling each agency's budget justifications. The information is typically submitted to congressional appropriators and then made available on agency websites sometime after the official White House budget submission, which is due the first Monday of each February. But the documents aren't easy to find, and some agencies don't post them online at all. Up next, I'll be joined in the show by Jason Fichtner, a senior lecturer and an associate director of the Master of International Economics and Finance program at Johns Hopkins University, and Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. We'll discuss Social Security, retirement planning, fiscal and economic policy, monetary policy, and long-term fiscal responsibility. We will be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Jason Fichtner and Bob Bixby. Bob is the Concord Coalition's executive director and a regular contributor on the show. Jason is a senior lecturer and an associate director of the Master of International Economics and Finance program at Johns Hopkins University. He's also a fellow at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Previously, he was a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason. Jason served in several positions at the Social Security Administration, including as Deputy Commissioner of Social Security, Chief Economist, and Associate Commissioner for Retirement Policy. He also served as Senior Economist with the Joint Economic Committee of the U.S. Congress. He's also worked at the U.S. Treasury, Georgetown University, and Virginia Tech. His work has been featured in the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Investor's Business Daily, the Los Angeles Times, the Atlantic, and USA Today, as well as broadcast by PBS, NBC, and NPR. Welcome to the show, Jason and Bob.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure to have you both on the program, and we're going to cover, I think, quite a few topics today, but we're going to focus up front on the topic of Social Security and retirement planning. Jason, you've written a number of pieces on retirement planning and Social Security, a couple recently on the wealth of generations with attention focused on millennials, and then how retirement savings will change by 2050. So I'm going to open the floor with a rather broad question. How has the wealth of different age groups changed in recent decades, especially relative to preparedness for retirement? And obviously I have a vested interest in this question because I'm a millennial.
So let's take the sort of the two or three things that first come to mind, do this broadly. The first thing, of course, is employment opportunities. And one thing that sort of changed when you think about generations, you think about, so I'm 49, my dad worked for the Chrysler Corporation for most of his life, that and some parts of private practice. My mother worked for a fitness company for 30 years. And so a lot of people my parents' age, and definitely my grandparents' age, tend to work for one company their whole life, and they had a pension plan. You think about millennials today, and now they change jobs frequently. You know, again, I'm 49, and I've had 7 or 8 employers. You rattled off so many of them already. And that sort of changes in some ways what that means for retirement security, because a lot of employers used to have a defined benefit pension plan. And now we've shifted the risk on individuals with defined contribution plans, which move as you move your job. And sometimes portability is there, sometimes it's not. And that can create leakage issues, or whatever savings you have, you take out and you cash into your new job and you spend that money. We're also seeing a change in home ownership. So originally you start thinking about, again, our parents, our grandparents, they got a house early, they paid it off. And when they retired, their house was paid off. We are seeing each successive generation delaying paying off their house. We're also seeing, like with millennials, a delay in purchasing a house. And for most people, when they retire, their house is their largest financial asset. So we see people approaching retirement now with more debt, with still having housing debt, and maybe not having the retirement security that their previous generations, their parents and grandparents might have had. And that's creating some tailwinds for them as we start thinking about retirement security.
So, Jason, does that mean we're at a point in our society where we should be rethinking how we plan for retirement, when retirement takes place, or even how Social Security operates?
Yes. A great way to say yes to all the questions. And like taking those in chunks. So one is, we always talk about like the accumulation stage of retirement. Like you need to save for retirement. We don't do a very good job talking about the decumulation phase. Like once you get there, what do you do? And again, thinking about that defined benefit to defined contribution change in our retirement security, the defined benefit plan, you retired, they gave you the gold watch, and you had basically an annuity that set you up for life. You got a fixed monthly payment that took you out to your lifetime. Now people get this defined contribution plan, they retire and they're given the lump sum. You saved up $100,000, $250,000, $500,000, $1 million, whatever the number is. And they tell you goodbye, good luck, have fun. They don't tell you what to do with it. And so part of this is now changing the nature of the discussion to say, what does it mean to have that DB style security in a DC world? And that could be talking about more about annuities and guaranteed lifetime income, which we should do more of. And annuities sometimes turn people off because they're not willing to give up sort of that lump sum for a guaranteed income. So we have to change the way we have that discussion with people about retirement security and trying to move towards guaranteed lifetime income. And then to your point about Social Security is the best inflation protected annuity out there. It gives you, you know, security. It gives you lifetime income as long as you live, monthly income as long as you live, and it's adjusted for inflation. And we have to figure out how to make sure that Social Security is there for everybody, because it does face financial challenges that are coming up potentially the next decade.
I want to get Bob in the conversation here, but I have one more question before we do. You mentioned portability issues and avoiding leakage, meaning like you take something out of an account, spend some of it, and then put it in a new account. That's how I interpreted it, at least.
Yes.
How do you improve portability? How do you incentivize avoiding leakages, especially for younger people as they're starting to look ahead to their future and at least thinking about saving for retirement? Because God knows it's very difficult right now for younger generations to get out from under that mass amount of education debt and other personal debt to get to the point of actually saving.
That's a really good question, Chase. And I think it's one that requires a lot more nuance. This is not a one-size-fits-all sort of policy.
I'm all for nuance. Dive right in.
Yeah, that's, you know, nuance is what we desperately need in Washington, D.C., and we get so little of, unfortunately. But when we start thinking about people with leakage, it's very tempting when you start changing jobs, especially when you're younger, to look at that money that's been saved in the defined contribution plan and just cash it out. Even take the penalty or use that money to pay off student loan debts or maybe for a down payment on a house, as opposed to rolling it over. And so on the policy side, we could do more things to make automatic rollovers more easy for people to do, where your employer can contact your new employer and they can do the paperwork and you don't have to. That would sort of make it easier. And also just some educational materials to talk about the opportunity cost of what it means when you take out that money, and having people think about their future self and their needs for retirement. And I know that's difficult because you think about your current needs, right? I've got to pay rent. I've got to pay off student loans. I've got to pay the mortgage, or I want to save for a house. And thinking about retirement, which is,
or you have a kid,
or you've got a kid, and so you keep saying, Jason's telling me to save, but I got a kid who needs diapers or health care, or I want to save for that kid's child care or education and college as well. So there's always opportunity costs and trade-offs. And one thing I will say, and we've made this sort of advice, I usually tend not to give financial advice, like what to invest in, but I will say, make sure you take care of your retirement before you take care of your kids. That does not mean you should avoid planning for their college savings, but make sure you are secure before you start thinking about their security.
That kind of reminds me of the flight attendant instruction, put your mask on before you put on the smaller person's mask that might be sitting in your lap or next to you.
Yes, that's exactly a good analogy to use. I like that.
That whole thing about put on your mask has a whole new meaning now, too. I mean, you can't.
Yes, in this instance, I'm talking about the oxygen mask that drops out of the.
Right. Put on the other mask, the one that drops, not the one that you're already wearing. Yeah.
That won't help you.
Well, we mentioned security and social security. You know, a lot of reports come out showing that the pandemic and its effect on the budget have accelerated the potential insolvency of the two Social Security trust funds a bit, but even without that acceleration, they were projected to go to become insolvent within 15 years or so, which is, you know, within the lifetime, and you know, it's a short time. 15 years isn't as long as it used to be, and so Social Security becomes an important, Social Security reform becomes an important subject. And, you know, I think that people are scared of that when they hear the term. They think, okay, this can't be good. I mean, I like Social Security, but when they say reform, something bad's going to happen here. So I just wanted to get your take on some of the options that might enhance retirement security while extending the solvency of the program?
So I this is a very important question, Bob. And I think it's important for people to understand that when the last Social Security trustees report came out in April of this year, it did not include the effects of COVID. And so the recessionary effects were not included. And the combined trust funds for the old age survivors, the retirement program, and disability insurance program combined was 2035. And so there's discussion now about what would the depletion rate date be if we continue to have recessionary tendencies and impact, because you have less people paying in because of payroll taxes, less people working, less taxes going in. That sort of speeds up, if you will, the depletion of the trust funds. And some analyses differ. I think Boston College says it might be 1 or 2 years. It gets you down to 2033. But the Bipartisan Policy Center, we did an analysis that said, what would happen if the pandemic-related recession is similar to what we saw in 2008, Great Recession. And again, with the Great Recession, we basically hit a peak unemployment of 10.4%, I think. We hit 14% or more with the pandemic, and the rate of acceleration was much larger with the pandemic. But if we have a similar recession now as we did in 2008, that could move the trust fund depletion up to 2028, which is now within this decade, and would force a lot of sort of changes to the fiscal, with the revenue coming in, as well as the outlays going out. And this gets to your point, what do you do? By law, Social Security is considered to be solvent because it can only pay out in benefits what it brings in revenues. So if Congress does nothing, then we get to a trust fund depletion and we can pay roughly 75% to 80% of benefits. But you think Congress is going to let all the senior citizens take a 20-25% haircut on their benefits? Probably not. But the taxes required to make up that difference is going to be somewhere around 3.7 percentage points, 4 percentage points. And if someone said, are you willing to pay 4 cents more to save Social Security? You might say yes, but when you're paying 12.4% now and you ask to pay 16%, and you frame it as, are you really willing to pay a 30% tax increase? The answer is no. So how it's framed is going to make a difference. Unfortunately, my guess now is that Congress will resort to what they always do, is just borrow money. And we're going to see general revenue transfers to make up Social Security shortfalls. And there might be some changes a little bit to the payroll tax policy. There might be a little bit of changes to benefits, trying to curtail it for higher, wealthier individuals. Right now, a certain percentage of your Social Security benefits are taxable, but not all of them. I could see Congress making all of the benefits taxable for high income earners. or those with wealthier accounts. But the leverage we have, this is not, you know, the math is easy to sort of figure out. You either have to raise taxes, reduce benefits, or a combination of the two, or borrow money, which means you're shifting the tax obligation away from payroll taxes, which are a defined contribution, to general society to pay for through borrowing and future tax increases later, whether that's on individual taxes or corporate taxes, or maybe we get a value-added tax.
Yeah, I think they've delayed so long on the reforms that it almost does seem inevitable now that there'll be some sort of general revenue bailout of Social Security, at least as a bridge to maybe, because, you know, you're talking about retirement policy, and so you can't make sudden changes in the program, particularly on the benefit side. I suppose you could raise the taxes more suddenly, but that has an economic that has a more of a near-term impact on the economy if you're raising payroll taxes. I wanted to talk, just get your your quick impression on two of the most fundamental questions. Where Social Security having to do with, say, the economy and savings and growing the economy? One is a workforce incentive, which, you know, trying to keep people in the workforce longer, because one of our problems with the long-term economy is that workforce growth is practically ground to a halt. And a lot of that has to do with demographics. So some people ask, is there a role for Social Security in encouraging longer work lives? That's one. The second is the issue of retirement savings. Some people have, and in fact, I have, in interest of full disclosure, been in favor of some sort of element of mandatory savings being added to the program, not as a carve-out account, as some people used to call them, but as an add-on for that we used to talk about and when people were talking about Social Security. So I know it's unfair to ask two very huge questions. Yeah, I think they're important just in terms of the overall economy, not as it's how Social Security can be part of a long-term economic growth agenda.
So you're exactly right to be focusing on this issue the way you framed it. And Social Security does have major implications for workforce participation. And I think we need to think about what that means going forward for retirement security, both in the sense of making sure the program is sustainable and solvent for workers when they retire and for those who are disabled and can't work, but also what it means for those who want to have a longer working life when they get into their 60s, mid-60s, late-60s, and 70s, because that payroll tax is a huge disincentive to work. It's a cost for employers, and it's a reduction in the after-tax wage rate for employees. And for some who are getting to the retirement age, it's a negative return. You don't get any additional benefit in those extra years unless you have 0 years to replace it. You're basically just paying taxes and not getting any protection for it or inflation adjustment and the insurance value. So one of the things I think we should think about doing is figuring out a way to maybe relieve older workers that having to pay the payroll tax, including the employer side. So basically the cost for employing an elderly worker would be less, and the after-tax return for working for an elderly person would be higher to encourage them to stay in the workforce. Again, not force them to do it, but to give them the nudge, the encouragement to do so. And that's sort of how Social Security fits some of the idea of savings. And then I think an add-on account, Bob, is a great idea. Bill Gale at Brookings Institution and Gary Koenig at AARP and I have a proposal out called Start Accounts, supplemental transition accounts for retirement, and we call them Start Accounts. And the idea is there would be a 2 percentage point mandatory add-on account, 1% paid by the employer, 1 percentage point paid by the employee, which would go into a managed pool account, similar to what you might have as a 401k plan. And this would be designed to be that bridge between those who can't work at age 62 and want early Social Security retirement benefits and helping them get delayed credits for a higher benefit amount. Or for those who want to continue working, it could turn into a lump sum for them. And so this basically does two things. One, it encourages longer work lives, but it also encourages asset building and wealth building, which for many low-income people, they don't have the ability to save right now. And this provides it to the Social Security system. So I think those are really good things. We have to think about not just Social Security solvency, but what Social Security can do to help savings and help encourage longer working lives. I want to go back to one more thing Bob said, because it was before, so it's still in my mind about Some of the things you think about Social Security reform, just to go back to the challenges, when they did the last major set of reforms, the Greenspan Commission in 1983, we're here in 2029, we're still implementing some of those reforms. So for example, the retirement age for me is gonna be 67. Today it's 66 and 8 months, I believe. So we're still putting that into place, and we're doing this now 30 years later, 40 years later. And the challenges, if you look back at the 83 reforms, they were very, very politically difficult to put through. The financial hole we find ourselves in today is much larger than it was in 83, which just means the challenges are that much more difficult.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say the third rail of politics is still very much that 30 years later. You mentioned your work with BPC, Jason, and a publication you put out was about helping Americans claim Social Security at the right age. I'm pretty sure this was written pre-pandemic. So I'm just curious, we talked about the pandemic's impact on the fiscal health of the program. How might it impact, if at all, when people decide to retire and claim Social Security benefits?
So one of the things that many people may be confused about with Social Security is that the lingo sort of confuses people's understanding of the benefit structure. And so there's something called the full retirement age, which again, for me, will be 67. For people retiring today, it's basically 66 and 8 months. But you can get benefits as early as age 62 and claim as late as age 70. They are designed to be what's called actuarially neutral, meaning if you claim at age 62, you'd get a reduced monthly benefit, but presumably for a longer period of time if you live to the average age. Where if you delay claiming until 70, you get a higher monthly benefit, but presumably for a shorter period of time, again, assuming the average age. But that difference in monthly benefit can be a huge amount. Assuming your full retirement age benefit's $1,000, if you retire at age 62, it's going to go down to a little over 700. That's almost a 30% reduction in your monthly benefit. If you wait until age 70, it goes up by basically about 25, 27%. That's a huge increase in the monthly purchasing power you get by delaying. And a lot of people don't realize that happens because you hear the age 62 number is often referred to as the early eligibility age. You think, oh, early. It's like getting in line early for the movie theater. I can get in line early to go to a sports stadium. Early, you don't think about there's a penalty for early. And so what we need to do is change the nomenclature and talk about the minimum benefit and the maximum benefit. And so people, when they come into Social Security, say, wait, what is this minimum benefit age and maximum benefit age? Does that change the equation? So the modal age people claim at is 62. And I'm not sure how people realize they're getting a reduced benefit. And this gets to your question, Chase, about COVID. If people, we saw in the Great Recession, there's a slight uptick in the number of people that would claim at age 62. If you lost your job and can't get reemployed, and you're 62, 63, et cetera, Social Security looks very tempting. And it might be worthwhile to claim benefits early when you need them. But we try to talk about in the paper, if you have other options, for example, maybe drawing down from your retirement account, your IRA account, you may be better off still drawing down money from your retirement account and delaying Social Security, because for each year you delay, you get an 8% increase in your monthly benefit. That goes a long way when you start getting into your 70s and 80s and 90s. And again, for many of us, retirement may be a lot longer than you think. And that protection Social Security gives you, whether you're working longer or getting it through an annuity value of Social Security, is very beneficial and helpful to creating a secure and dignified retirement.
I'm going to stay in the same vein of the work you're doing or have done with BPC, but on a pretty different topic, because we're nearing the end of our segment. So I wanted to make some time to actually talk about this because I think it's very timely. You co-authored pre-pandemic a couple papers. One was titled, Does the Debt Matter? And it took a look at MMT, modern monetary theory. And then the other paper was Putting America Back on Track, a Responsible Bipartisan Approach to Fiscal Policy. So we're going to have over a $3 trillion deficit this year. We're expected to have over 100% of GDP in publicly held debt next year. Clearly, we're on a pretty unsustainable path. Obviously, the actions Congress took this year to respond to the pandemic were necessary. So I'm not sitting here harping on like, oh, we spent way too much money to get out of this health crisis. But before all this, we were already on an unsustainable path. So before I ask any questions, let's start with the paper that took a closer look at MMT. Are we living an MMT experiment right now? Or is this a theory that really we shouldn't dabble with?
I think there's a cautionary note to be made here. So the MMT has sort of gotten a bad rap because they're hard to pin them down on things. The first tenet is that for a nation that has sovereignty of its own currency and is the world's reserve currency like the U.S., you can sort of continue to print money up until the rate of inflation without creating more inflation. And in some sense, that's kind of true. We see this all the time right now, what's going on with monetary policy. As the economy grows, it needs more money. And as long as you keep growing the money to fit the economy and not too much, you don't create inflation. If you don't give enough increase in the money supply, you basically could create the point where prices go up too much and there's not enough dollars to pay for it. Now you get to the idea is, can you just keep printing money? And the idea is no. So, inflation everywhere is a monetary phenomenon. And the idea behind inflation is if you have too much money chasing too few goods, then you bid up the price for them because those dollars become less worthwhile and the goods are still tangible. What we're seeing now going on in COVID is because of the rapid nature at which people lost their jobs, lost their income, there was this gap between what people could afford to pay and what the economy was basically assuming could be paid for. That could get filled in now with government sort of spending on a Keynesian idea of pumping money to the economy. And it did prop up the economy. The problem is if you keep going forward, now you're going to have people who aren't creating productive aspects of society adding to the economy, but just giving them dollars, and that's going to bid up inflation. At some point, this comes true, and there's no such thing as a free lunch. We'll have to pay for our lunch. The question is when, and when does that happen? When do we start seeing the tipping point? And the Federal Reserve has been buying up a lot of assets, state and local bonds, corporate bonds. At some point, they can't do any more of that, and we're going to have a reckoning. Now, I don't know when that's coming. But just to give you an idea, economists love to talk about opportunity cost and what that means. So right now we have a very low interest rate environment. But if we keep on our current track, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that by the end of this decade, we'll be paying out $1 trillion a year in interest costs. Last year, all of Social Security cost us $1 trillion. That's a lot of interest money you could spend on education, on roads, on broadband updates. That's tax dollars that have to come out of your pocket. So at some point, taxes are going up, and that's going to slow down the economy. So we really need to look at what the debt and deficit is going to do to us and start taking measures now to sort of get back on track. As you mentioned in the prelude to this question, yes, we're in a pandemic. We have to control it, but it doesn't mean we have to spend all of our resources. And we sort of seem to be in this mode now of like, do anything we can to keep the economy going. And then in a few years, we're going to look back and say, what the heck have we done?
It's kind of a follow-up on the MMT. Transitioning out of where we are now is something that the Concord Coalition is very much focused on, as you have a free pass right now. And I'm struck by how the debate is not focused on the long term, but we will at some point have to start thinking about getting the budget and the economy back to quote unquote normal. And should Congress be thinking about, I know nothing's going to happen before the election, but I mean, just like in the ideal world, the advice to a new administration coming in, should they be thinking about goals, guidelines for debt to GDP, setting something that is reasonable without slamming on the brakes that would hurt the economy. It's going to readjust at a higher level than many of us would have liked or thought several years ago. But should Congress and the new administration, as they implement policies coming in, try to come up first with some sort of guidelines on spending, revenues, and debt to GDP?
Yeah, no, Bob, I think you're exactly right. And the first thing when thinking about sort of getting back to sustainability is not making things worse. Again, we're in a pandemic and there's somewhat of free pass, but it's not free. And that's the point we have to mention is that we're basically putting on a credit card. And at some point that credit card bill comes due. And the first thing when you start talking to people who are in credit card debt is stop spending. Now, to your point, it doesn't mean you stop spending down to zero and everything comes to a halt. But you've got to ratchet it down or at least slow the growth of spending so the economy catches up. And I think we need to start putting in some sort of long-term plan that gets our debt down to a sustainable level, maybe somewhere around 70 or 80% of GDP, because we're over 100% today, and that is not going to be sustainable for us. And realize that we're not going to do this overnight. Anyone who keeps talking about now we can do a balanced budget in 1 year, you can't. Chase mentioned the BPC paper. We did that as part of an exercise for the Peterson Foundation. And we did it a few years prior, we probably could have gotten to the point where maybe we got to a balanced budget in 10 years. Now, I don't see any way to do that politically without causing major drastic cuts to entitlements or major increases to taxes, both of which aren't sustainable. we've kind of lost, we've waited too long to go back to full circle to our conversation. We've waited long to make changes. And now we're looking at what can we do over our next 20-year time horizon to put us back on a glide path. I think the 10-year budget window most of us talk about for reforms is going to be very, very difficult to do now. And we've got to start thinking of a 15, 20-year so that it looks like it's more reasonable, responsible, and the pain is more spread out, whether that's on the revenue side, the spending side, or both. And we're going to have to get comfortable, if you said, with a higher level of spending. I mean, historically, you know, if we go back a few years and then say historically, we're looking at about 18% of GDP for revenues for federal income taxes combined, 21% or so of spending GDP. Now we're going to get comfortable with 23, 24%, and we can't have a 5% gap in revenue and spending. But to raise taxes up to 20, 20% is going to be harmful unless you spread out the pain a little bit and say like a consumption tax, and that's not really popular. And so we have this political problem where people seem to want European-style benefits but don't want European-style taxes. And people keep saying tax the rich, but if you look at all the countries with the benefits, while they do have a higher level of taxation on income, they also have a value-added tax, which is a consumption tax. It's a broad-based tax to fund these services, and that's the one thing we don't have. And if we do that, that's going to spread the tax on the middle class and also on the poor. But that's probably the only way we're going to get there.
The well, one of the things that we joke about is the ultimate bipartisan deal in Washington, which we seem to have adopted by default, is let's have the Democrats' agenda on spending and we'll take the Republicans' agenda on taxes. And you put that together and it doesn't add up because it gives you about a 5 or 6 or 7% gap of GDP is on an annual basis. So, I mean, you can see how the deficit and debt adds up pretty quickly at that point. That's a bipartisan compromise we don't want to have.
I agree. And we should also, because someone might point out to us later that, well, Japan has over a 200% debt to GDP. And while they're not the biggest rock stars in the economy, they're not in a depression either. But the difference is thinking about the savings level. The Japanese economy has a lot of internal debt. The citizens borrow by the debt of the government, where ours, we're putting a lot of it externally. And if you want to see what happens with external debt, just go back to Greece. For Greece, most of their debt when they hit the crisis was external. It wasn't internal, so they couldn't just devalue the currency or pass on that debt to future generations. It was hitting them now. And so we really need to think about what this means from a global standpoint. We are right now the country's world reserve currency, but that might change. I don't know whether or not people will start buying more European debt, Japanese debt, Canadian debt, Chinese debt, and try to lump it together and create some sort of new debt instrument to get out of sort of the US, you know, currency and the dollar being the reserve currency. But if we lose the reserve currency status, you know, God help us, we're really going to spiral and have a really out of control debt and interest crisis.
I think we're going to have to leave it there for today, gentlemen.
That's a horrible place to leave
it. I know, it's a horrible place to leave it. My segue was going to be, this is a good place to leave it, but it really is not. But
if everybody does the right thing, we can pull out of this before it becomes bad.
There it is. That's a good place to leave it. So,
and maybe we take the next 30 seconds. Like, we're doom and gloom, but is there optimism? And I think in some ways there are. I mean, we start off with millennials. Keep in mind that they're the most educated generation yet. So they hopefully, if they get the entrepreneurial spirit, they may create new inventions, whether it's life-saving drugs or new technologies, which could grow the economy. Maybe we'll get smart and do something on the climate side, maybe put it on a carbon tax, and maybe that's a better way to raise revenue than a value-added tax if we can ramp it up slowly enough to encourage people to adopt better technologies that to reduce climate, that could create new industries. So there is hope, but the thing is, we have to start doing it now. It's, you know, when the fire's at your front door, that's the wrong time to call and say, help, I need help. You need to start doing preventive stuff ahead of time.
That was a great way to leave it, Jason. And we are unfortunately out of time. I've got dozens more questions as usual, but we'll have to have you back on the show. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Jason Fichtner, and Bob Bixby. We discussed Social Security, retirement planning, fiscal and economic policy, monetary policy, and even some long-term fiscal responsibility. Up next, Bob will be back to discuss the latest monthly budget report. Jason and Bob, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thank you.
We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined once again on the show by Bob Bixby. Bob is the Concord Coalition's Executive Director and a regular contributor on the show. Welcome back to the program, Bob.
Thanks, Chase.
Always a pleasure having you on Facing the Future. Today, we are going to pick up talking about the Congressional Budget Office's monthly budget review from August of 2020. And it's usually a pretty monotonous document, but we're trending to some pretty high deficits in this year and the years ahead. So why don't you give us a quick summary of what CBO had to say about August of this year?
Yeah, so there's nothing monotonous about this year's budget numbers. They're fluctuating quite a bit. Well, through the first 11 months of the fiscal year, with 1 month left to go, the month we're now in, CBO reports that the federal government has run a budget deficit of $3 trillion, which is about three times more than was projected at the beginning of the year, which means that when the fiscal year began, we were already projected to run a deficit of $1 trillion, which is pretty darn big by historical standards. And it turned out to be about three times, so far this year, three times bigger. So we got one more month left to the fiscal year. September tends to be a good month for the budget, just because of quarterly tax filings. So in normal years, you might even expect a surplus in September. I'm not really expecting a surplus this year. The numbers have jumped around a bit, but CBO is still projecting that when all is said and done, we'll be over $3 trillion for the end of the fiscal year.
Which is hard for me to wrap my head around. I mean, we've never had a $3 trillion deficit in our nation's history. So just rattling that number off almost, you know, rather casually, Bob, it's a pretty big number. And you mentioned we were already on track for a pretty large deficit, about $1 trillion for this year. Why is there such a big difference between what was even expected for this year, not even let alone this year compared to last year?
Well, it is almost all of it is COVID-19 spending. You know, spending is up about 46% so far this year. Revenue is down, but not nearly by as much. And a lot of it was because of the stimulus checks that went out, the money that flowed through the PPP program and the unemployment compensation. Enhanced unemployment compensation. Those were, you know, a lot of that has paid out, and that really caused spending to go way up. You do see some effects on revenue from the slowdown in the economy, but it's really a spending phenomenon in response to the shutdown of the economy.
And I know this. At least I don't think it's part of this particular report, but from what I understand, CBO is expecting deficits to start trending back downward, at least back towards $1 trillion again within the next couple of years. Am I right? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah. I mean, you really see this spike, and then the deficit is projected to begin to come back down, but we're still looking at extraordinarily high deficits for the next couple of years before they plateau back to around where they were projected to be at their already high levels. So it's like a deficit fever for the next year or two, but the patient wasn't so healthy going in.
An apt example, I guess, given that one of the primary symptoms for COVID-19 is a fever, Bob. So thanks for that. Before we move on to what's going on the rest of this fiscal year, so what, the last 2 weeks here of September, just a quick reminder for our listeners, what was driving sort of those structural deficits in the budget already? I mean, $1 trillion is still a lot of money. And before the pandemic, we were kind of up in arms about, hey, continued $1 trillion deficits is not ideal. How did we even get here in the first place?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's basically an underlying structural budget deficit. That means that spending is projected to grow on autopilot faster than revenues. The revenues tend to grow with the economy, and the spending grows with the, in the federal budget, the part that is growing on autopilot is basically driven by demographics and healthcare costs, which are rising faster than the economy. So you put that together and you have a situation where budget deficits on autopilot get larger and larger every year and add to the debt. And that was certainly driving the $1 trillion deficits pre-pandemic.
And so we're looking at the end of the fiscal year rapidly approaching. Congress was away for most of August, so they didn't have any COVID legislation passed. They didn't really advance the ball in terms of the appropriations process. Where do things stand, and what could we potentially expect to see here in the closing weeks of this fiscal year?
You got two big negotiations going on. One is they have to pass appropriations bills by the end of the fiscal year, which is, the end of this month. And if they don't, there's a government shutdown. So no appropriation bills have passed. Each house is supposed to pass 12, and then they get together and do a compromise thing, and that's how the government is funded. So they haven't been able to do any of those bills yet. So as of right now, you'd be staring at a shutdown. But the two sides have agreed that they do not want to have a shutdown. They don't want to have a fight over a shutdown. So they've decided to do some sort of a short-term, what's called a continuing resolution, or CR, which would basically, the idea is to keep spending at the 2020 levels, fiscal year 2020 levels, for a couple of months. They haven't decided how long yet. And that would prevent a government shutdown until they might fight again about it after the election. But they want to get through the election, and they don't want a government shutdown. The other line of negotiation is over a new COVID relief package. And there's a lot of agreement on some of the elements, but just not agreement on some of the bigger ones, like how much should states and local governments get, and what should be the employment, the unemployment benefit bonus to replace the $600 one that expired at the end of July. So there's still some big pieces to negotiate there, and it's kind of looking like they're just going to take a gamble and not do anything until maybe after the election.
Yeah, so you mentioned that both the appropriations process and the COVID legislation are currently on separate paths, but it seems like the timing for both is lining up for maybe shortly after the election. Do you think it's possible those end up being, one giant omnibus bill and a COVID package tied together? You think that's largely what it depends on, the result of the election? Like how could this potentially shake out?
Well, it's possible that they might eventually merge. What is surprising to me is that the COVID part of it seems less and less likely to happen, despite the fact that the economy is still sputtering along. There are signs of that the recovery is slowing, and you would think that that would spur some action. On the other hand, the bottom hasn't fallen out since, April, May, and you begin to see some jobs coming back and the unemployment rate falling. And both sides have something to tout from the last jobs report, politically speaking, whether the economy is growing or the economy is the recovery is slowing. That's why I say it almost seems that nothing is going to happen until perhaps after the election. I don't think that's good. But I think both sides have decided that they're willing to gamble that they are right on the trajectory of the economy. And what's at stake is the economy, and it's a pretty big gamble.
Yeah, I'm not particularly a fan of those, quote, political win-wins, which actually give both parties justification to simply walk away from the table when there's so much that still needs to be done. This is Facing the Future. I've been talking to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. We discussed the latest monthly budget review by the Congressional Budget Office and the latest on a possible continuing resolution and COVID legislation that may or may not happen regardless of what happens in the election. Thanks for joining the show, Bob.
Thanks.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.